area rugs. The last thing you want to do while holding your baby is burn yourself or slip. Do not get a crib that has sides that can be lowered. Drop-side cribs seemed like a good idea because they made it easier for parents to get babies in and out, but they were responsible for thousands of injuries and dozens of deaths and are now banned. Most contemporary cribs have a feature that allows you to lower the mattress as your baby gets bigger and stronger. Any teething rails, those are the hard plastic caps over the top rails of the crib sides, should be firmly attached. They're going to get chewed on a lot. You don't want them to come off. Before you buy, check the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission's website, cpsc.gov, for any recall information. Crib mattresses. Couples are often surprised that mattresses are usually sold separately from the crib. The theory is that some babies prefer firm ones while others prefer softer. Since your baby is going to be spending around 15 hours a day on that mattress for a while, don't skimp. There's no reason why the one you buy now shouldn't last you through several kids. Just make sure it comes with a moisture-proof protector. A few safety tips. The firmer, the better. Studies have shown that there is an increased risk of SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, if the mattress is too soft. For the same reason, never put pillows in the crib. The mattress must fit tightly into the crib, no more than one finger's width between the edge of the mattress and the side of the crib. You'll have a choice between inner spring and foam. Neither is necessarily better than the other. The main thing is to go for quality over price. There are a lot of cheapies out there that either won't last or are made using questionable materials. Consider flame-retardant coverings and organic or eco-friendly materials, if those things are important to you and your family. Crib accessories. Sheets. Get at least three of the fitted kind. They usually come in regular or organic. No bumpers. Even though they can't move very well, babies somehow manage to ram their heads against the sides of the crib, hard enough to leave an impression of the slats or bars on the top or back of their head. It supposedly reminds them of the feeling of having their head smashed up against your partner's pubic bone for the last month or two of the pregnancy. Until recently, crib bumpers, which are like soft pads that run along the inside of the crib, were pretty much de rigueur because they supposedly kept the baby's head from being bruised. But new research shows that they can be a severe suffocation hazard. Babies may run into them with their face and may not be able to back away. And an entrapment hazard. Babies can get caught between the bumper and the mattress. Don't use bumpers of any kind, not even the mesh, breathable ones, which eliminated the suffocation risk but left the entrapment problem. No bumpers may mean a few bumps and bruises to your baby's head, but she'll be a lot safer. A dust ruffle. Extremely optional, unless you're Martha Stewart. A mobile. Optional, but nice. Some of the most beautiful and most expensive ones are made to be looked at from the side, where the person who bought them is standing. But remember whom the mobile is really for, and think about whether your baby is really going to be interested in looking at the bottom of a bunch of cars or the undersides of a group of jungle animals. Babies prefer high contrast patterns to simply bright colors. You can get mobiles that merely hang, some that play incredibly annoying music when you wind them up, some that run on batteries, and some that ring bells or make other noises when the baby swats at them. A bassinet, sometimes called a Moses basket. For the first few months of your baby's life, you may want him or her to sleep in the bedroom with you. If nothing else, this arrangement will make breastfeeding a lot more convenient. Bassinets come in a variety of styles: wheels, no wheels, handles, no handles, rocking, no rocking. But because they generally accommodate a baby for only 3 months or so, you'll be better off borrowing a safe one from someone and passing it on to the next new parents. To choose a safe one, use the same guidelines as for cribs: no posts and slats you can't get a soda can between. As with the crib mattress, the one in a bassinet should be firm and fit snugly against the sides, and always follow the manufacturer's weight and age recommendations. A sidecar or co-sleeper. These are essentially three-sided cribs that attach to the side of your bed, most likely on your partner's side. The idea is that breastfeeding may be easier with the baby close by. Green babies. People generally select the products they buy based on price, quality, availability, and brand. In recent years, though, Consumers are paying more attention to how products impact the environment, whether it's their home environment or the one we all live in. A number of recent national polls have found that around 70% of American consumers say they would prefer to buy environmentally friendly products than non-environmentally friendly ones. However, only about 35% of consumers say that they would pay a premium for it, and only 25% actually do buy eco-friendly products. As you might expect, those numbers are higher for consumers aged 18 to 34 and lower for older generations. So what does this have to do with you and your baby? Plenty. You might be concerned that the paint you used in the nursery could emit toxic fumes. Or maybe you're worried about the bleaches in your laundry and you'd prefer that your baby wear nothing but organic fabrics. Or perhaps you're worried about how disposable diapers are impacting the environment. Whatever your concern, there are environmentally friendly alternatives to just about any product you're currently using, although the most common reason given by those who don't buy green is that the products cost too much. You can find some of these products at places like Walgreens, Sears, Whole Foods, Babies R Us, and even Walmart, or at your natural grocer. But the widest selection and the most resources are going to be online at places like greenhome.com and ecomall.com. A car seat. This may be the most indispensable baby item of them all. Again, you won't be able to take your baby home from the hospital without one. It's a critical purchase, so don't skimp. Stay away from hand-me-downs unless they're practically new, have never been in an accident, and conform to the very latest standards. Some are designed to face backwards. Others only face front. Some convert from one to the other. You may want to consider getting two, a small one, perhaps with handles so you can carry the baby around with you, that can be used until the baby reaches 20 pounds, and a larger one for later. There are also some car seat stroller combinations out there. Check Parents Central at safercar.gov/parents before you buy any car seat. A changing table. Changing tables come in an unbelievable variety of sizes and configurations. Some have drawers so that they can be used as a dresser when a changing table is no longer needed. The problem with drawers, however, is that you have to remember to take out what you need before you get started. When you're in the middle of changing the baby, the last thing you want to be doing is fumbling around blindly for a clean outfit. Be sure to get a foam pad for the top of the table and a couple of washable pad covers. You should also stock your changing table with plenty of diapers, baby wipes, diaper rash ointments such as A&D or Desitin, cotton swabs and water for cleaning the umbilical cord stump, and baby shampoo and soap. A mild one like Neutrogena or Dove is best. Note: stay away from any kind of talc-based baby powders. They can cause breathing problems and lung damage if inhaled. Cornstarch-based powders seem to be better, but there's no solid evidence that either one does anything to help with diaper rash. The most important things you can do are change diapers regularly and pat or air dry your baby's bottom before closing the diaper. A portable playpen. Perfect for children less than 34 inches tall and lighter than about 30 pounds. Not only does it fold up compactly enough to check as luggage when you're traveling, but it can also be used at home to keep your baby from crawling under your feet while you're cooking, for example. Some of our friends' children essentially lived in their playpens for the first 18 months of their lives. A stroller. A good stroller can make life worth living, so don't waste your time or money on one that won't last. We took our oldest daughter and her stroller all over the world, and it was still in good enough condition 3 years later for her younger sister to use. Getting a quality stroller doesn't mean you have to buy the one with every available option. Stick to the basics, such as weight. You'll spend a surprising amount of time carrying the stroller, loading and unloading the car, getting on and off buses and trains, going upstairs, and so on. You'll also want to consider ease of folding, brakes, and balance. You don't want the thing tipping over backwards with your baby in it. Finally, make sure the handles are long enough for you to push the stroller when you're standing up straight. Most strollers are made to be used by women, which means that if you're over 5'6 or so, you're going to have to stoop a little to push. You might not notice it at first, but after a while, your back will give you trouble. Some of the smarter manufacturers have adjustable handles. City dwellers who do a lot of traveling on subways or buses will want a sturdy but collapsible stroller. preferably one that you can fold with one hand while holding the baby with the other. Otherwise, it's next to impossible to get onto public transportation, at least without annoying everyone behind you. Those stroller car seat combos are especially bulky and hard to fold. There are dozens of stroller manufacturers, and the strollers come in a nearly infinite range of designs and functions. Some are designed for running, some accommodate twins or more. Some look like Harley-Davidson motorcycles and convert to a child's bike after the stroller years are past. Some look generic, some have military camouflage, and some seem to serve no purpose but to show off how much money you have or used to have before you mortgaged your house to buy the stroller. A bathtub. A small plastic wash basin is better than a sink for newborns for several reasons. First, you probably won't want to have your new baby's little body in a place where you might have had raw meat or other foodborne sources of bacteria. And you certainly wouldn't want to have your baby pooping in a place where you might be putting food. Of course, you'd wash the sink before and after the bath, but still, gotta think about these things. Second, you'll actually be giving your baby sponge baths, with the baby lying down in the tub, not soak in the water baths. In the sink, you'd have to hold your baby with one hand and do the washing with the other. Squirmy, soapy babies are hard enough to hold on to with two or three hands. A monitor. These handy devices let you listen to or watch your baby wherever you are, and I really do mean wherever. Some of the higher-end video monitors allow you to get real-time feeds on any internet-enabled device, which is good if you have to go back to work and don't want to miss a second of your baby's life. If you're just going for a plain vanilla audio monitor, try hardware or sporting goods stores where you can get walkie-talkies and room monitors for quite a bit less than a similar item at traditional toy and baby gear stores where they call them baby monitors. A baby carrier. Whether it's a sling, a front pack, or a backpack, you'll want to get something that you can use to carry your baby around in. Make sure it's comfortable, and if you're planning to share it with your partner, adjustable. Diapers. Who would have thought that diapers would become a political issue or that something so ordinary could make or break friendships? But they have. Until just a few years ago, there were two camps, disposable and cloth. People who used disposable were evil, pumping millions of tons of human waste, plastic, and chemicals into the landfill, where they'd stay in their present form for thousands of years. There were also biodegradable diapers, which broke down after only 500 years. People who used cloth diapers, in contrast, were the white knights, saving the earth for our children. The reality is a bit more complicated. Although cloth diapers are all natural, they're made of cotton, which is taxing on farmland. And in order to sterilize them properly, you wouldn't want to put a diaper on your baby that some other kid had worn, diaper services bleach them and wash them 7 times, it's true, in near boiling water, thereby consuming a tremendous amount of power, water, and chemical detergents. The clean diapers are then driven all over town in trucks that fill the air with toxic pollutants. Bottom line, there is no clear winner. But wait, it gets more confusing by the day. Regular disposables are still out there and still playing the role of bogeyman, but you can also get a number of eco-friendly disposables that offer some or all of the following features: chlorine-free, latex-free, dye-free, fragrance-free, gel-free, made of corn-based materials, GMO-free, hypoallergenic, organic, compostable, and even flushable. On the other side of the argument, we need to talk about reusables instead of cloth. My wife and I started out by using cloth diapers for our oldest daughter, but every time she filled one, the diaper had a nasty tendency to siphon the contents away from my daughter and onto my pants. Not pleasant. And that meant even more laundry. It's possible that this phenomenon was the fault of my poor diapering technique, but I was convinced that disposables, which have elastic around the leg openings, do a better job of keeping what belongs in a diaper actually in the diaper. Today, all that has changed. Cloth diapers are no longer rectangular and held together with pins or elastic clips. Now they're hourglass-shaped and hidden inside stylish, washable covers that Velcro on and stretch to fit your baby. Properly installed, these diapers can be just as leak-free as disposables. There are also hybrid diapers, which use a washable exterior but have disposable and sometimes flushable liners. Kids who grow up with disposable diapers tend to become potty trained later than those who use cloth, because the disposables do such a great job of sucking up moisture that babies have no real incentive to get out of them. If you want to see this in action, just visit someone you know who has a toddler. Chances are he'll be running all over the house with his diaper hanging down to his knees because he's got a quart of urine in there, but he's as comfortable as a fly in, oh, you know. Either way, plan on going through around 3,000 diapers before you light the candle on your baby's first birthday cake, and 6,000 to 8,000 before your baby starts flushing the toilet. Double or triple that if you have twins or more. Costs are all over the place, depending on the type of diaper you go with, where you live, whether or not you shop the sales, and whether or not you buy and wash your own. The best place to do all your comparison shopping is diapers.com. Watch out for triboluminescence. Never heard of it? Well, maybe it's time you should. In 1999, English housewife Jill Furlow got a fright late one night when she saw green sparks shooting out of her sleeping 11-month-old son's disposable diaper. She called the manufacturer, who assured her that the sparks were the result of triboluminescence, a perfectly harmless buildup of energy probably caused by the friction of the baby's bottom rubbing against the inside of the diaper. It's actually exactly the same chemical reaction that produces the sparks you see when you bite down on a wintergreen lifesaver in a dark room. You can also see the same thing if you strike two sugar cubes together, as if striking a match, or you yank on a roll of tape. Unlike static electricity, triboluminescence doesn't generate any heat. The boy apparently slept through the entire episode, and there's no record of any injury to anyone. Just something to think about. Formula. Breastfeeding is, of course, the best thing, but if you need formula, you can use powdered, full-strength liquid, or liquid concentrate. But when you start checking prices, your partner may decide to keep breastfeeding a while longer. When we weaned our daughters, we put them on the powdered formula. I made a pitcher of it every morning and kept it in the fridge. Well, it's almost over. I know you're raring to get to the best part of all, so let's move on to the ninth month. The ninth month. Dear, it's time. What's going on with the baby? Over the course of this last month of pregnancy, your baby will be growing at a tremendous clip, putting on a quarter to half a pound a week, although she'll stop growing a week or so before the birth. Before she finally decides to leave the warm uterus, she'll weigh 6 to 9 pounds, less, of course, if she's a twin or triplet, and be about 20 inches long. So big that there will be hardly any room for her to kick or prod your partner anymore. Her fingernails and toenails are frequently so long that they have to be trimmed right after birth, and the lanugo and vernix that have been covering and protecting her little body are starting to slough off. And despite the widespread myth that babies are born blind, her sight is coming along just fine. During her last weeks in captivity, she'll practice her sucking, hand clenching, head turning, swallowing, blinking, and even breathing. What's going on with your partner? Physically, she may be having trouble sleeping and be exhausted, but she may get a renewed sense of energy when the baby's head drops into the pelvis and takes some of the pressure off the stomach and lungs. She may have stopped gaining weight and may even lose a pound or two, but she's still just plain miserable, with increased cramping, constipation, backache, water retention, and swelling of the feet, ankles, and face. If her belly button was an innie before, it may have become an outie. The change isn't permanent, though. She's probably got little to no interest in sex, although some women's interest actually increases. Emotionally, she's more dependent on you than ever, afraid you won't love her after the baby is born. After all, she's not the same woman you married. She could be impatient, tired of being tired, frustrated with being so big, and can't wait for the pregnancy to be over. Or she may not want it to end. She may be getting a little short-tempered, tired of answering, "So when's the baby coming?" questions, especially if she's overdue. She may be afraid she won't have enough love to go around, what with loving you and all. She may be afraid that she won't be ready for labor when it comes. She's becoming increasingly preoccupied with the baby and perhaps a sudden and unexplained interest in Martha Stewart and interior decorating. And she's creating endless lists of things that absolutely, positively have to be done, in most cases by you, before the baby shows up. What's going on with you? Confusion. In just a few weeks, you're finally going to meet the child you've talked to and dreamed about and whose college education you've planned. But be prepared. The last month of pregnancy is often the most confusing for expectant fathers. At times, you may be almost overcome with excitement and anticipation. At other times, you may be feeling so scared and trapped that you want to run away. In short, all the feelings, good and bad, that you've experienced over the last 8 months are back. But now, because of the impending birth, they're more intense than before. Here are a few of the contradictory emotional states you may find yourself going through as the pregnancy winds down. On the one hand, you may be feeling confident about your readiness to be a father. On the other, you may be worried and unsure about whether you'll be able to handle your dual roles as husband and dad. You may really be looking forward to spending some time with your baby while your partner is recuperating, but you may be worried that you won't know how to do all the things that she usually does for the family. If this last part is true, you'd better learn how to do the laundry and run the dishwasher right now. You're looking forward to being involved, but you feel sidelined by your partner and jealous of her connection with the baby. If you've taken on a second job or increased responsibilities at work, all you'll probably want to do at the end of the day is go home and relax. But with your partner less and less able to handle physical tasks, you may be greeted at the door with a list of chores that need to be done. You may want to take a good chunk of time off after the baby comes, but you're worried about how that will affect your career or whether your joint checking account can take the hit. You and your partner may be feeling an exceptionally strong emotional bond with each other. At the same time, your sex life may have completely disappeared. You may be horny as hell, but you saw some pretty graphic childbirth videos in your prep class, and you can't get those images out of your mind. As your partner gets more and more uncomfortable, she may feel less and less like going out with friends, so the two of you may be spending a lot more time together. This could be the last chance you have to enjoy some quiet, private time before the baby comes, but it may also be an unwelcome opportunity to get on each other's nerves. You may find yourself spending a lot more time with friends and family members who have small children, or you may find yourself avoiding families with kids. You may be practically giddy at the idea of holding your child in your arms, but petrified that you'll drop him. Increased dependency on your partner. By this time, your attention and that of your friends and family is focused squarely on your partner and the baby. Since you're the person she's closest to and sees most often, your partner is going to be increasingly dependent on you, not only to help her physically, but to get her through the last month emotional ups and downs. At the same time, though, you're going to be increasingly dependent on her as you go into that last month thrill ride. Your partner's increased dependency is considered a normal part of pregnancy. But thanks to the ridiculous gender-specific way we socialize people in this country, men are supposed to be independent, strong, supportive, and impervious to emotional needs, especially while their partners are pregnant. So just when you're feeling most vulnerable and least in control, your needs are swept under the rug. And what's worse, the one person you most depend on for sympathy and understanding may be too absorbed in what's going on with herself and the baby to do much for you. This results in what Louis Zayas calls an imbalance of interdependence, which leaves the father to satisfy his own emotional needs and those of his partner. In addition, in many cases, this imbalance essentially becomes a kind of vicious circle that accentuates the stress, intensifies feelings of separation, and heightens dependency needs. In other words, the less response you get to your needs, the more dependent you feel. Feeling guilty. Especially in the last month or so of the pregnancy, many men begin to blame themselves for what they think they've been putting their partners through. Yes, you're the one who got her pregnant. And yes, she's uncomfortable as hell. But strange as it might seem to you, your partner does not blame you for what she's going through. She understands and accepts, as you should, that this was her idea too. And that, at least short of surrogate motherhood or adoption, there's simply no way to have a baby without going through this. So quit torturing yourself. There are a lot more productive things you can be doing with your time during these last few weeks. Staying involved. Sensitivity. The bottom line is that as the pregnancy winds down, your partner is likely to be miserable and uncomfortable. Although there's not a whole lot you can do to ease her burden, here are a few suggestions that might make the final stretch a little more bearable for both of you. Quit answering the phone. Change the outgoing message on your voicemail to something like, "Hi, no, we don't have a baby yet, and yes, Jane's fine. We'll be updating our Facebook page as soon as the baby arrives. If you're calling about anything else, please leave a message and we'll call you back." That may sound a little snotty, but believe me, it's a lot less snotty than you would be if you were really answering the same questions 20 times a day. Stay nearby whenever you can. Come home a little earlier from work. Give away those basketball tickets and postpone that long business trip. Stay in touch. A couple of quick calls, texts, or emails to her every day can make her feel loved and important. They'll also reassure her that you're all right. And never go anywhere without your phone. The one time you do, she'll call and immediately panic that you've either left her or were hit by a bus. Stay as calm as you can. She'll be nervous enough for both of you. Be patient. She may do some pretty bizarre things, and the best thing you can do is just bear with her. If the house has already passed the white glove test and the car has been waxed twice and she wants it all done all over again, do it. She needs the rest. Review the breathing, relaxation, mirroring, and any other techniques you plan to use during labor. If she wants it, give her some time to herself, and if she wants time with you, make sure you're there for her. If she hasn't stopped working, encourage her to do so, especially if she doesn't like her job. In a recent study of women in Southern California, researchers found that those who took leave in the last month of pregnancy, starting around 3 or 4 weeks before delivery, had a C-section rate that was 4 times lower than women who didn't take leave. And while she's on leave, encourage her to get plenty of sleep. Exhaustion during the final weeks of pregnancy also increases the C-section rate. If you're running out of ideas, take a look back at the Ways to Show Her You Care section of the PDF that accompanies this audiobook and try the ones you didn't get to before, or those that got the most mileage the first time around. What if she's overdue? There is nothing more frustrating than starting the 10th month of a 9-month pregnancy. You've already given up answering the phone, afraid it's another one of those, "What are you doing at home? I was sure you'd be at the hospital by now," calls. And you're sick of ending every conversation at the office with, "Now, if I'm not in tomorrow, don't forget to..." The empty bassinet looks forlorn, and you're just dying to meet the baby face to little wrinkled face. In most cases, however, couples who think they're late really aren't. When doctors tell a pregnant woman her due date, they often neglect to add that it's only a ballpark figure based on an assumed 28-day menstrual cycle, and there's always a window of plus or minus 2 weeks. If your partner's cycle is long, short, or irregular, her official due date could be off by as much as 3 weeks. And even if her cycle is like clockwork, it's nearly impossible to tell when you conceived. First trimester ultrasounds, which almost all women have, are more accurate, coming within 3 or 4 days in either direction of the actual due date. Second trimester ultrasounds are less accurate, with a margin of error of around a week either way. In the third trimester, ultrasounds can be even less accurate, as much as 10 to 12 days off. There are also a number of other factors that can influence due date accuracy. African American and Asian women, for example, tend to have shorter pregnancies by 3 to 5 days than Caucasian women. Younger women have shorter pregnancies than older ones, and first-time moms typically deliver as much as 10 days after their due date. The problem with this is that your partner may have been fixated on a specific due date, and when she goes past it, she's likely to be bitterly disappointed. While going past the due date by a week or so is usually not a problem, being truly overdue can have serious consequences. The baby can grow so large that he or she will have problems passing through the birth canal, thus increasing the chances of a difficult delivery or a C-section. After a certain point, the placenta gets so old that it can no longer provide adequate nourishment for the baby. This can result in the baby's losing weight in the uterus, increasing the risk of fetal distress. There may be no longer enough amniotic fluid to support the baby. There may be inadequate room for the umbilical cord to perform properly. If your doctor feels that the baby is overdue, he or she will most likely prescribe some tests to make sure the baby's still okay. The most common are an ultrasound to determine the level of amniotic fluid as well as to get a general idea of how the baby's doing, and a non-stress test, which monitors changes in the baby's heart rate and movement in reaction to certain stimuli. If the baby passes these tests, the doctor will probably send you home, telling you to repeat the test in 3 to 7 days if the baby hasn't come by then. Or he or she may suggest that you schedule a date for labor to be induced. If all of this starts getting you down, remember the immortal words of obstetrician J. Milton Houston of New York Hospital. In all of my years of practice, I've never seen a baby stay in there. She's got more control than she realizes. Women can't control when they give birth, right? Well, not so fast. Researchers at the Yale University School of Public Health analyzed millions of U.S. birth certificates with a focus on Valentine's Day and Halloween. They found that 5% more babies were born spontaneously on Valentine's Day, and 11% fewer babies were born on Halloween than on any other day in the week before or after those holidays. Chemically induced births and elective C-section births were also higher on Valentine's Day and lower on Halloween, but those can be scheduled for any time within reason. Becca Levy, who led the study, speculated that pregnant women may be subconsciously avoiding Halloween because of its association with evil and death, and choosing Valentine's Day for its association with cherubs and love. What if it's a boy? Sadly, most people don't think about, and consequently never discuss, circumcising their sons until the thing is staring them in the face, so to speak. So if you and your partner haven't made up your minds about circumcision yet, now is the time to do so. Of course, if you know you're having a girl, or if you and your partner have already decided what you're going to do, you may not think that this section will apply to you, but listen to it anyway. You just might learn something. But if either of you is still undecided, the pros and cons of circumcision are going to be coming up in just a minute. If you and your partner aren't on exactly the same page, be careful. In recent years, the whole circumcision debate has become extremely political, and the tempers run pretty hot on both sides. Why you might want to consider circumcision. Religious reasons. Circumcision is a traditional ritual practice for Jews and Muslims. A while back, the wife of a local rabbi went to court to get an injunction preventing her husband from circumcising their newborn son. Needless to say, their marriage didn't last much longer. Other cases dealing with the same issue have ended up the same way, with the couple splitting up. Health. A number of studies have shown that circumcision reduces a boy's, and later a man's, chances of getting HIV and some other sexually transmitted diseases, developing urinary tract infections, or cancer of the penis, and may reduce his future partner's chance of developing cancer of the cervix. Uncircumcised boys are 10 times more likely to develop a urinary tract infection than circumcised ones, 1 in 100 versus 1 in 1,000. But the risk was very small to begin with. In addition, circumcision completely prevents phimosis, a condition in which the foreskin can't be retracted. Phimosis, which affects about 1 to 2% of uncircumcised males, can be cured later on by circumcision, but the procedure gets a lot more painful with age. Short of that, the foreskin may be able to be loosened by gentle stretching. Do not do that without proper medical supervision, though, or by using a topical steroid cream prescribed by your pediatrician to soften it. Hygiene. A circumcised penis is a lot easier to clean, both for the parents and for the boy himself. Conformity. If you've been circumcised, your son will probably want to look like you. Worldwide, only about 20% of boys are circumcised. But in the United States, it's a lot more popular, and having done it will probably make him look more like the other boys in the locker room. Nationwide, about 57% of boys are circumcised, but depending on where you live, the rate may be higher, like 67% in the Midwest, or lower, 40% in the West. Those rates are probably a little low anyway, since they count only circumcisions done in hospitals. Given that post-birth hospital stays are sometimes as short as 24 hours, there's sometimes no time to get it done. Pleasure. The American Academy of Pediatrics says that male circumcision does not appear to adversely affect penile sexual function, sensitivity, or sexual satisfaction. Millions of circumcised men around the world have perfectly delightful sex lives, and doctors have found little, if any, conclusive proof that circumcision has any negative effects on boys' or men's sexual, psychological, or emotional health. In fact, in a recent article in the Journal of Urology, Turkish researcher Temusin Senkul and his colleagues tested this hypothesis by asking uncircumcised men who were about to be circumcised for religious reasons to rate their sexual satisfaction and function before the procedure and at least 12 weeks after. The only difference between the before and after was that it took the circumcised men a little longer to ejaculate, something many men would consider to be a good thing rather than a bad one. In other similar studies, some men actually reported an increase in pleasure. Why you might want to consider not circumcising your son. Pain. No matter how you look at it, getting circumcised is painful, and the cut will take about 3 days to heal fully. Until the late 1990s, most circumcisions were done without anesthetic. Today, most are done with either a numbing cream or an injection. OBGYN Marjorie Greenfield cites research showing that babies who get some pre-circumcision anesthetic cry less, have a more normal heart rate during the procedure, and are less irritable than those who were medication-free. Younger doctors and those practicing in the Western states are more likely to use pain blocks than older doctors or those anywhere else in the country. Whether the circumcision is done by the baby's doctor or the mother's depends on the doctor's medical training and where he or she is practicing. Other risks. Complications, while extremely rare, can occur. There is about a 1 in 500 chance of bleeding, penile injury, or local infection due to circumcision, but death is almost never a risk. In 1979, for example, there was only one circumcision-related death in the entire United States. A recent comprehensive study by Dimitri Christakis and his colleagues comparing the risks and benefits of circumcision found that the procedure prevents 6 urinary tract infections for every complication endured, and that about 2 complications can be expected for every case of penile cancer prevented. Circumcision remains a relatively safe procedure. However, for some parents, the risks may outweigh the potential benefits. Conformity. If you haven't been circumcised, your son will probably want to look like you. Pleasure. Some people believe that the foreskin is there for a purpose, to protect the tip of the penis, and that removing it can cause the penis to be less sensitive, which will reduce sexual pleasure later in life. A number of anti-circumcision groups claim that penile circumcision has the same impact on boys that female circumcision has on girls. There is absolutely no evidence that this is true. Female circumcision, more accurately called genital mutilation, is practiced in some parts of the world and involves completely or partially removing a girl's clitoris or sewing the labia minora together. The specific purpose is to reduce a girl's sexual pleasure or the ability to have intercourse before marriage, which supposedly will make her less likely to stray later. There is no comparison between the two procedures, and frankly, I think it's offensive to mention them both in the same sentence. Is it necessary at all? Some claim that many of the health risks thought to be reduced by circumcision may in fact be reduced simply by better hygiene, something that can be taught. The American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Urological Association have both taken fairly noncommittal positions. The American Academy of Pediatrics says, after a comprehensive review of the scientific evidence, the health benefits of newborn male circumcision outweigh the risks, but the benefits are not great enough to recommend universal newborn circumcision. The American Urological Association says, neonatal circumcision has potential medical benefits and advantages, as well as disadvantages and risks. Neonatal circumcision is generally a safe procedure when performed by an experienced operator. When performed on healthy newborn infants as an elective procedure, the incidence of serious complications is extremely low. Bottom line, it's a personal decision that's totally up to you and your partner. Taking care of the circumcised penis. If your son is circumcised, his penis will be red and sore for a few days after the circumcision. And until it's fully healed, which can take from a week to 10 days, you'll need to protect the newly exposed tip and keep it from sticking to the inside of his diaper. A few tiny spots of blood in his diaper for up to 2 days is perfectly normal, but call your doctor if there's more blood than that, if the redness gets worse after 3 or 4 days, or if your son hasn't urinated within 6 to 8 hours after the circumcision. How you care for your son's penis will depend on which method was used to do the circumcision, so ask the person who performed it before you do anything. The general rule is that you'll need to keep it dry and the tip lubricated with petroleum jelly and wrapped in gauze at every diaper change. If there's a plastic ring over the tip of the penis, it's called a plastibel, just leave it alone and let it fall off by itself. Again, check with the person who did the procedure for specific care instructions. Taking care of the uncircumcised penis. If you elect not to circumcise your son, you'll still have to spend some time taking care of his penis. 85% of boys under 6 months have foreskins that don't retract, so don't try to force it. Fortunately, as boys get older, their foreskins retract on their own. By age 1, 50% retract, and by age 3, 80 to 90% do. The standard way to clean an uncircumcised penis is to retract the foreskin as far as it will comfortably go and gently wash the head with mild soap and warm water. There's absolutely no need to use antiseptics, cotton swabs, or any other special cleaning measures. Dealing with contingencies. Labor. Real or false? By now, your partner has probably experienced plenty of Braxton Hicks or false labor contractions, which have been warming up her uterus for the real thing. Sometimes, however, these practice contractions may be so strong that your partner may think that labor has begun. The bottom line is that when real labor starts, your partner will probably know it. This may sound strange, especially if she's carrying her first child. Nevertheless, the majority of mothers I've spoken to have told me that it's true. But until then, you and she may not be sure whether the contractions and other things she's feeling are the real thing or not. So before you go rushing off to the hospital, take a few seconds to try to figure things out. If it's false labor, contractions are not regular or they don't stay regular, and they don't get stronger or more severe over time. If your partner changes position from sitting to walking or from standing to lying down, the contractions usually stop altogether or change in frequency or intensity. There is little or no vaginal discharge of any kind. There may be additional pain in the abdomen. If it's real labor, contractions are regular and they get stronger, longer, and closer together with time. There may be some blood-tinged vaginal discharge. Your partner's membranes may rupture. The water that breaks is really the amniotic fluid that the baby has been floating in throughout the pregnancy. And there may be additional pain in the lower back. Planes, trains, and automobiles. It may seem like half the births you see in the movies take place on the backseat of a speeding taxi, in a snowbound cave, in an airplane bathroom, or at the end of a bungee cord. While those sorts of images may sell movie tickets, the reality is that about 98% of babies are born in hospitals. And most of the non-hospital births were planned that way. Nevertheless, at some point, just about every pregnant couple, okay, it's really maybe more of a guy thing, starts worrying about giving birth unexpectedly. Emergency births. Emergency births fall into two general categories. Either you have a lot of time before the actual birth, say you're snowed in or you're trapped in your basement because of an earthquake or shipwrecked and you know you're not going to get to a hospital for a while. Or you have little or no time before the birth, like you're caught in traffic, you're parachuting to safety, or your partner's labor was extremely short. Either way, there's not a whole lot you can do to prepare. Of course, your first step should be to call 911, assuming that's possible. If you have some time, try to make sure that your partner is in the most sheltered area of wherever you happen to be and that she's comfortable, which, given her condition, is a relative term. If you have facilities available, get yourself some clean towels or sheets and boil a piece of string or shoelace and a pair of scissors or a knife. Then, just sit tight and let nature take its course. If you don't have time, try to stay cool. Handling a birth is not as difficult as you might think. Doctors who do it for a living, in fact, usually show up just a few minutes before the birth and are there primarily in case any complications arise. The truth is that most of the time, babies pretty much deliver themselves when they're good and ready. The ones who seem to be in a hurry usually come out without any complications. Whether you have time to prepare or not, once the baby starts to come, the procedure for performing a delivery is the same. And you'll know the process has started when your partner can't resist pushing, or when the baby's head or any other part of the body is visible. For the rest of this chapter, we'll describe what you should do if there's no way to avoid delivering the baby yourself. The information isn't intended to replace the years of training your doctor or midwife has, so don't try this at home unless there is no other option. Step 1. Preparation. Call for help if you have reception. Try to keep your partner focused on the breathing and relaxation techniques. Put a pillow or some clothing under her butt in order to keep the baby's head and shoulders from hitting a hard surface. Step 2. The head. When the head begins to appear, don't pull on it. Instead, support it and let it come out by itself. If the umbilical cord is wrapped around the baby's neck, slowly and gently glide it over the head. Once the head is out, try to remove any mucus from the baby's nose and mouth. Although the baby's passage through the birth canal is usually enough to do the trick. Step 3, the rest of the body. Holding the baby's head, encourage your partner to push as the baby's shoulders appear. After the head has emerged, the rest of the baby's body should slide out pretty easily. Support the body as well as the head as it slides out. Despite what you may have seen or heard, you don't have to slap the baby's bottom to make him cry. He'll take care of that and the associated breathing all by himself. Of course, if he's blue or not breathing at all, you'll need to make use of those baby CPR skills you hopefully learned a month or two ago. Place the baby on your partner's chest and encourage her to begin breastfeeding right away. Breastfeeding makes the uterus contract, which helps expel the placenta and reduces the chance of excessive bleeding. And don't worry, the umbilical cord is generally long enough to allow the baby to nurse while it's still attached. Dry the baby off immediately and cover mom and baby to keep them as warm as possible. Step 4, cutting the cord. Using the clamp or the shoelace or piece of string you boiled a while ago, tie a tight knot around the cord 3 or 4 inches away from the baby. If you know you can get to a hospital within 2 hours, don't cut the cord yet. If you're not going to make it by then, tie a second knot in the cord about 2 inches further away from the baby and cut the cord between the knots with your knife or scissors. Don't worry about the cord stump that's attached to the baby. It will fall off by itself in a week or so. Step 5, the placenta. Don't think your delivery job is over just because the baby's out. Anywhere from 5 minutes to a half an hour after the baby is born, the placenta will arrive. Do not pull on the cord to help things along. In most cases, the placenta, which is surprisingly large and meaty, it kind of reminds me of a hefty chunk of liver, will slip out on its own with a soft plop. When it does, wrap it up in something clean or drop it into a plastic bag, but don't throw it away. Your doctor will want to take a look at it as soon as possible. After the placenta is out, gently massage your partner's lower abdomen every few minutes. This causes contractions, which limit blood loss and start the process of returning her uterus to its original shape, or at least close to it. Things to remember during an emergency birth. Call for help as soon as possible. Try to relax. Do everything carefully, thoughtfully, and slowly. Keep the area where the baby will be delivered as clean as possible. And baby CPR. If you haven't taken a baby CPR class yet, you really should consider it, just in case. An emergency kit. It's extremely unlikely that your partner will give birth anywhere but in the hospital. However, if you want to make absolutely sure all the bases are covered, here's a list of supplies to keep at home, in the car, or any place else you and she are likely to be spending a lot of time during the last month or so of the pregnancy. Please keep in mind, though, that this list is for emergencies only. If you're planning a home birth, you'll need a lot more supplies. Chucks pads. Those are large, sterile pads for absorbing blood, amniotic fluid, and so forth. They're available at medical supply stores. If you can't find any, newspapers are fine. Don't worry, a little ink won't hurt anything. Non-latex gloves, a suction bulb so you can hoover out the baby's nose and mouth, a clamp for clamping off the umbilical cord. You can get these at any hospital supply store. If you can't find one, you can do the job with a clean string or shoelace. A large plastic zipper bag to store the placenta, clean scissors or a knife for cutting the cord if necessary, some towels to warm the baby and mother after the birth. Well, I guess that just about takes care of it. You've gone through the entire 9 months of pregnancy. But the most important part of all is still ahead, labor and delivery. And that's exactly what we're going to be talking about in the next chapter. Labor and delivery. What's going on with the baby? Your baby's going to be pretty busy for the next little bit, and since the baby and your partner are going to be going through the same stuff at the same time, but from very different perspectives, let's move right on to what's going on with your partner. The entire labor process typically lasts 12 to 24 hours, toward the high end for first babies and the low end for subsequent ones. But there are no hard and fast rules. Labor is generally divided into three stages. The first stage consists of three phases. Stage 1, Phase 1. Early or latent labor is the longest part of labor, lasting anywhere from a few hours to a few days, but the average is about 8 hours. Fortunately, you'll be at home for most of it. At the beginning of this phase, your partner may not be able to feel the contractions. Even if she can, she'll probably tell you that they're fairly manageable. Contractions will generally last from 30 to 45 seconds and come as much as 20 minutes apart. Over the next few hours, they'll gradually get longer, as long as a minute, stronger, and closer together, perhaps as little as 5 minutes apart. Every woman will have a slightly different early labor experience. My wife, for example, had from 6 to 12 hours of fairly long, fairly regular, like 3 to 5 minutes apart, contractions almost every day for a week before our second daughter was born. Your partner may have bloody show, a blood-tinged discharge, backaches, and diarrhea. Phase 2, active labor, is generally shorter, from 3 to 5 hours, but far more intense than the first phase. It's likely to last as much as 10 minutes longer if you're having a boy than if you're having a girl. If you aren't already there, it's time to head to the hospital. In the early part of this phase, your partner will still be able to talk through the contractions. They'll keep getting closer together, 2 to 3 minutes apart now, longer and stronger. As this stage progresses, she'll start feeling some real pain. The bloody show will increase and get redder, and your partner will become less and less chatty as she begins to focus on the contractions. Phase 3, transition, usually lasts 1 or 2 hours, and once it starts, you can stop wondering why they call it labor. Your partner's contractions may be almost relentless, each lasting as long as 90 seconds, and with just 2 or 3 minutes from the beginning of one until the beginning of the next one, there's barely any time to recover. The pain is intense, and if your partner is going to ask for some drugs, this is probably when she'll do it. She's tired, sweating, her muscles may be so exhausted that they're trembling, and she may be vomiting. Stage 2, pushing and birth. This is by far the most intense part of the process, and fortunately for your partner, it lasts only about 2 hours. Only being a term that's used by anyone who's not in labor. Your partner would probably more likely describe how long this stage lasts as for friggin' ever. Your partner's contractions are still long, more than 60 seconds, but are further apart. The difference is that during the contractions, she'll be overcome with a desire to push, similar to the feeling of having to make a bowel movement. She may feel some unpleasant pressure and stinging as the baby's head crowns, meaning it starts coming through the vagina, but this will be followed by a huge sense of relief when the baby finally pops out. Stage 3. After the birth, delivering the placenta. Less than 20 minutes or so after the baby is born, the placenta will separate from the wall of the uterus. Your partner will continue to have contractions as her uterus tries to eject the placenta and stop the bleeding. We'll talk more about the placenta in a few minutes. What's going on with you? Starting labor is no picnic for her or for you. She, of course, is experiencing or soon will be a lot of physical pain. You, in the meantime, are very likely to feel a heavy dose of psychological pain. I couldn't possibly count the number of times, only in my dreams, thankfully, that I've heroically defended my home and family from armies of murderers and thieves. But even when I'm awake, I know I wouldn't hesitate before diving in front of a speeding car if it meant being able to save my kids. And I know I would submit to the most painful ordeal to keep any one of them from suffering. This instinct perhaps explains the adrenaline rush you'll probably feel. A team of Scandinavian researchers took fathers' pulses during the birth of their children and found that they went from an average of 72 beats per minute to 115 beats per minute just before the birth. But helping your partner through labor is not the same as deciding to rescue a child from a burning building. The most important thing to remember about this final stage of pregnancy is that the pain, yours and hers, is finite. After a while, it ends, and you get to hold your new baby. Ironically, however, her pain will probably end sooner than yours. She'll be sore for a few weeks or so, but by the time the baby is 6 months old, your partner will hardly remember the pain at all. If women could remember it, I can't imagine that any of them would ever have more than one child. But for 6 months, a year, even 2 years after our daughter was born, my wife's pain remained fresh in my mind. And when we began planning our second pregnancy, the thought of her having to go through even a remotely similar experience really scared the hell out of me. Staying involved. Checking things out when you're checking in. Here's what Sarah McMoyler recommends to her students. On the day you check into the hospital, take a few minutes to survey the room and the labor and delivery unit. You're going to be in that room for hours and hours. Go ahead and open up the cabinets to see where they keep the washcloths, the gowns, bath blankets, extra pillows. While you're at it, try to find out where the wheeled stool is for you to sit on, the shower, the nurse call button, and the controls for the electronic bed. Most of the time, the nurse will get these for you, but if she's also busy caring for other patients, understand that she may not be able to get them as quickly as you need them. While you're getting the lay of the land, be sure to locate the ice chip maker, the snack bar, and the place where they keep those warmed-up blankets. And make a special point of introducing yourself to the nursing staff. Let them know about any special concerns your partner might have. Does she have any allergies? Did she have a bad pregnancy experience sometime in the past? Is she afraid of needles? And tell them about your goals, in particular your desire to be as involved as possible, while also letting them know that you'd love their input and advice. This is a great time to ask questions. They really are on your side, and they know a ton about labor and delivery. The warmer your relationship with the medical team, the smoother the whole experience will go. Being there, mentally and physically. Despite your fears and worries, this is one time when your partner's needs, and they aren't all physical, come first. But before we get on to how you can help her best get through labor and delivery, it's important to get a firm idea of how to tell when she's actually gone into labor and what stage she's in once she's there. We're going to go through this in some detail now. To help you review for later, we've included a really lovely chart that summarizes all of this in the PDF that accompanies this audiobook. Stage 1. Phase 1, early or latent labor. Although the contractions are fairly mild at this point, you should do everything you can to make your partner as comfortable as possible. Back rubs, massages, and so forth. Some women may tell you exactly what they want you to do, others may feel a little shy about making any demands. Either way, ask her regularly what you can do to help. And when she tells you, do it. If taking a walk makes her feel better, go with her. If doing headstands in the living room is what she wants to do, which is fairly unlikely at this point, go ahead and spot her. The easiest way to tell whether she's really in labor is to watch the contractions. If they're getting longer, stronger, and closer together, it's the real deal. If not, take it easy. You should be writing down the contractions anyway, because when you call her practitioner to ask whether to head off to the hospital, he'll want to know what's been going on. During early labor, it's important for your partner to keep her strength up, so many OBs will recommend light eating, salads, soups, and so on. Drinking water during early labor is crucial. No matter what your partner does, you should eat and drink something. You need to keep your energy level up too, and you're not going to want to try to make a dash to the snack bar between contractions.